Just a quick word from our sponsor before we jump into today's episode. Optimizing your internal processes can often be a huge unlock for streamlining revenue and getting you and your team, if you have one, out of a manual process. If you're looking to reduce costs and headaches in one fell swoop, consider graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere, and you cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Everything seems to be more expensive these days, so proven ways to cut costs and boost performance at the same time, like NetSuite, are kind of a no-brainer. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/SPI. netsuite.com/SPI. Once again, netsuite.com/SPI. And now a quick word from our sponsor before we start the show. Ready to earn sustainable income while creating the work you're passionate about? Get started with Memberful. Whether you teach online courses, host a podcast, run a blog, or write a newsletter, Memberful has all the tools you need to unlock revenue and deeply connect with your audience through subscription membership. Their platform allows you to easily gate content, communicate with your audience, and tier membership access directly on your own website. Plus, with Memberful, there's no need to change your workflow. They work seamlessly and integrate with the tools you already use, including MailChimp, Discord, Zapier, ConvertKit, Google Analytics, and more. Utilize their powerful built-in features and dashboards and watch your business grow. The best part? Memberful gives you full control and ownership of your audience, your brand, and your business. Get started for free at memberful.com/SPI. One more time, that's memberful.com/SPI. Books. You probably read them. Maybe you've written them before. I personally have written 3 books, Let Go, Will It Fly, and more recently, Superfans. And my gosh, it is a chore, but also one of the most fulfilling things I've ever done. Big thank you to all of you who have read and or listened to any of my books. We're talking more about books today, specifically about the business and the process and how a book integrates into this amazing, potentially passive income opportunity, whether it's a fiction book or a nonfiction book. And today we're going to be speaking with a tremendously successful self-published author, previously traditionally published. He's going to tell a story about how he started there, failed, and then started his own thing, publishing on his own, and the secrets and the formulas for making that happen. You can actually find him at selfpublishingformula.com, but don't go there yet, because I want you to be convinced that this person knows exactly what he's talking about. And more than that, you can find his very, very successful fiction series. Actually, he has multiple series of books, and I actually get quite selfish here in this particular podcast episode, because one day I would love to publish a fiction book, and he's given me, and all of you out there who are interested in that as well, some tips, and then marketing tips, no matter what kind of book you have. I'm speaking with today none other than markjdawson.com, and you'll hear all about his books, his origin story, his failures, his successes, and tips that we can all use no matter what stage we're at today. Mark J. Dawson. But first, the intro.
Welcome to the Smart Passive Income Podcast, where it's all about working hard now so you can sit back and reap the benefits later. And now your host. Ask him about his food truck idea the next time you see him, Pat Flynn.
Hey, and real quick, our sponsor today is Uplift Desk, creators of office furniture designed to help you work better and live healthier. If you haven't tried a sit/stand desk before, this offer from Uplift is the perfect opportunity. Plus, you can support the show at the same time. Visit upliftdesk.com/SPI for 5% off your order. A desk should fit the user, right? Which is exactly why Uplift Desk has a ton of customization options. They're stable, the materials are solid. I mean, just the choices of material alone are incredible, all the way from laminate to eco to bamboo and even solid wood. The option to stand while working is just healthier, better circulation, better movement, which helps to reduce all kinds of different health risks and repetitive strains. And over 1 million customers have chosen Uplift Desk for their innovative designs, direct to consumer pricing, same day shipping. They can even give you free accessories with every desk. Uplift is a great deal, and they're built to last and include an industry-leading 15-year warranty, free shipping, free return shipping if you need to do that as well. So go to upliftdesk.com/SPI for 5% off your order. That's upliftdesk.com/SPI to get 5% off your entire order. Hey, hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to session 413 of the Smart Passive Income Podcast. My name is Pat Flynn, here to help you make more money, save more time, and help more people too. And writing books is definitely one of those things that can help you make more money, can help you get your message, your words, both on text, paperback, hardcover, or even on audio like Audible in front of more people. But it's a lot of work. And there's some secrets that a lot of well-known, very, very influential people like today's guest, Mark J. Dawson, who are just so generous in sharing their information. And this, I came out of this interview with just such energy and such excitement for diving into my next book, which I've just started to put on paper. I haven't yet quite finished the outline, but it's coming. It's coming. I'm just very thankful that I had this conversation before publishing it, because it's definitely going to save me a lot of time and help me make more money. And I'm hopeful that this will do the same for you. Like I said, and like I shared earlier, today we're speaking with Mark J. Dawson. You can check him out, markjdawson.com, to see his works there. And we have some other stuff for you later on that we'll point you toward. But for right now, let's just dive into the interview. Here he is, Mark J. Dawson. Mr. Mark Dawson, thank you so much for coming on the Smart Passive Income Podcast today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Pat. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a long-time listener. I've learned an awful lot from you over the years, so it's a real pleasure to come on and maybe give a little bit back.
Oh, you're going to give a whole lot back, because, Mark, you've just become this amazing powerhouse in the world of what you do, which is writing books, and you've taught many people how to write books. But I just want to talk about your books a little bit. You're known for a number of series. Tell us a little bit about the books that you currently have, and just like tell us about your work.
All right. So originally, I was traditionally published all the way back in 1999, 2000. I had a deal with a big publisher in London, one of the big ones. I think I earned, they gave me an advance of about £50,000, which was not a huge amount in those days, but it would be quite a lot today. And I thought, I was a lawyer at the time, so not a particularly good lawyer, and certainly not a happy one. And I thought this was the way I was going to get out. This was the career I always wanted to do. And this was how I was going to do it. And this was going to be the start. And it didn't really turn out that way. The books, they're not the best books in the world for a start. That's being generous. They're pretty bad books. And so that didn't help. But then the publisher didn't do that much in terms of promotion that I could see, you know, marketing. I remember going into a bookstore in my lunch break, went down to the bookstore and had a look and expecting to find them in prime position. But instead of eye level on the shelves, which is where I wanted them to be, you know, kind of face out, they were all the way down at the bottom, spine out, very difficult to see. Browsers wouldn't notice them. So anyway, I kind of rearranged the shelves to put them back into the order that I thought that they should be in.
I've done that.
Everyone's done that. But then, of course, I went back the next day and the staff had done their jobs and correctly returned them to the basement level again. So I stopped writing after that. I had a couple published. None of them were particularly good, as I said, and they didn't sell very much. I didn't earn the advance back. So that's kind of a black mark on my name when it comes to getting a third deal. So I kind of gave up. I changed jobs, did something I enjoyed a bit more in the film industry. And then a friend of mine, around about 2010, I think it would have been, had a Kindle. And I was kind of very, very slow to adopt the Kindle. I never thought I'd want to read on a device. And he told me that he had published something himself. And he was getting contact from readers, which is something that I never got. And also he was getting money from Amazon. And you know, I don't know about you, Pat, but the way that my relationship with Mr. Bezos works is normally, or at least up until that point, money went from my account into his.
Yes.
And my friend was telling me he was getting checks from Amazon. So I kind of started digging into what was possible and started to write. And first of all, published a kind of a noirish thriller called The Black Mile. And then since then, I've branched out into, I kind of write espionage thrillers now, books that are, I suppose, quite like Lee Child and Jack Reacher, that kind of thing, James Patterson. Mm-hmm. So I've got a couple of, two or three series, some spin-offs, and I've been a full-time writer for over 5 years now, and you know, I don't mind sharing numbers too much. I cleared 1.5 million last year in terms of book sales, which was, if you'd said to me that was possible when I was, you know, trying to rearrange those bookshelves all those years ago, I would have said you were nuts. But you know, it is possible, and it's a pretty cool way to make a living.
$1.5 million last year alone from self-published books.
Yes, that's just income on KDP. So that's the platform that Amazon has to enable you to publish. But it doesn't take into account audiobooks and deals I have with Thomas & Mercer is an Amazon imprint, so that more like a traditional imprint. So they publish some of my stuff as well. So all in, it's probably nearer to, but it's a pretty significant income. Not all profit, of course. There's costs in there, but
of course,
still it's you know,
that's incredible, Mark. Congratulations on that, and thank you for briefing us on the story. And now you teach several other people how to write self-published books, and you have very unique strategies and sort of a formula, if you will, for doing that. Can you give us a little insight on sort of your approach to, if for any writers that are listening or anybody who's thinking about writing, you know, how might we better think about the approach to position ourselves for success when writing books? Because a lot of people have written books and they just gone nowhere.
Well, I mean, the way I look at it is we have a website with another business called Self-Publishing Formula, which is probably the worst name I could possibly come up with, because it sounds a little bit snake oily that there's a formula to follow, which is not the case. It's kind of more of a mindset thing, really. So the way I look at it when I'm publishing things is that I'm creating assets. Intellectual property assets. In the first instance, it's a story which is expressed by way of a book. So that's one way that you can take advantage or, you know, monetize that asset. But there are other ways that you can split off and make money too, from audiobooks to film and TV to print, licensing, translation, foreign rights. All of these kinds of things can all make money for you, passive income. And the way I try to look at it is I approach it as professionally as I can. So I will put out the best product that I possibly can. So that means that I have a editorial process that my books go through, which is at least as good as the experience I had when I was traditionally published. Mm-hmm. I have a pro cover designer. So, I mean, I'm terrible with, you know, Photoshop. I just would not know what to do. So although I could do a cover, it wouldn't be a very wise thing for me to do. So I hire a designer who used to do covers for Tolkien and John le Carré and Stephen King, people like that. And he, a guy called Stuart Bache, he does all my covers and has done for about 5 years now. So when you look on the store, when you go to Amazon and you're browsing for a new thriller to read, my intention is that you would not be able to tell from either looking at the cover or the blurb or opening the look inside to look at the first few pages, you wouldn't be able to tell that there's anything different in the way that book was published between the way I've done it and the way Lee Child's publisher has done it. And that's something that not all indies get their heads around, but I think it's quite important to keep that in mind.
That makes sense. And so it's really a mental approach that you're taking that sort of establishes the groundwork for something that becomes much bigger than just the book itself. And I think a lot of us don't think of it in that way. For those of us who are now interested in also the fiction side of things, I know there's a lot of nonfiction authors who are listening, but I'm curious just for the fiction authors out there and those interested in that, including myself, what makes a story that sells? How? Because there's so many books that get published, stories that I'm sure the authors thought they were great, but they go nowhere. Mm. Why?
I think I've got a bit of experience with this. So when I was originally published, I decided my third book was going to be one that I would write with one eye very closely on what I thought the market wanted. So I my editor at the time had just published this Australian thriller writer who writes kind of action and adventure, men's adventure, I suppose you'd call it, kind of Indiana Jones style books. And I thought, that's easy. I bet I could do that really, really, really easily, and I'll make lots of money, It was a really arrogant thing for me to say, and also just completely unrealistic, because it actually, this author wrote very fast, pacey, addictive thrillers. That's why he was successful. And there's a real skill to do that. And I didn't read those books, and I wasn't therefore very good at writing them. So the thing I've learned since then is that what you want to try and do is you need to write something that you want to read, a genre that you like and that you have some experience in. And then that's the first thing. The second thing is you need to find something that you think will sell. And if you think of a Venn diagram, so you've got two circles. On the one hand, you've got what you like. On the other hand, you've got what you think the audience will like. And where those two circles intersect, that's what you should be aiming for. So for me, I mean, I love Lee Child. I love David Baldacci. I love those kinds of addictive, pacey, compelling thrillers. And it was very obvious to me when I did a little bit of research, actually almost no research, it was that obvious that there was a very hungry market for those kinds of books. So that was a real sweet spot for me. But it doesn't have to be that kind of big genre. I've taught authors, one in particular comes to mind, who she's got some kind of academic qualification in Scandinavian history, and she likes writing romances. So her niche is Scandinavian historical romances set in the 1700s. And she found that was the one circle. The other circle was she found an audience that was very hungry for those books because they just weren't getting served with any at all. And she took one of our courses on using advertising to boost sales, and I think she went from something like $800 a month to she cleared $35,000, and this was a while ago, and she's a solid six figure a month author now. So it's by approaching those kinds of, you know, marrying the art with the business side of things, and then finding, you know, making a decision based on that, that's where you can find the success.
Yeah, I love that. I think what you've just shared with me about one of your students is a big problem that a lot of people are having is, well, maybe they have a great story or have a great book that just isn't getting found. And it sounds like to me, you do teach how to use Facebook ads. Is that the answer to getting found, or are there other ways that we authors can have more eyeballs on our books?
Yeah, there are loads of ways now. I mean, the things have changed in Kindle over the last 10 years or so. So when I started, it was almost possible to upload a book and maybe make it free for a weekend, juice it with some promotion, some sites that would send out emails to readers who were looking for those kinds of books. You could do quite well with that and make decent money. There was much less competition. If you were even a little bit professional, your books would immediately stand out from the crowd. And Amazon was more organic algorithmic marketing, at least that's what it appeared that was happening when it came to Amazon. If you scroll forwards now to 2020, there are something like 8 million books on the Kindle store in the US at the moment. So when you upload your book, you're immediately throwing it out there into this sea of competing content, and it's very, very difficult for readers to find that book. So it's not really a luxury anymore to advertise. It used to be about 4 or 5 years ago, you didn't have to advertise, but it was still a good thing to do. It's getting to the point now that in order to be successful, and of course there's different definitions of success. There's commercial success, there's creative success, all kinds of things. But if you want to make enough money to take this seriously as a career, it is almost obligatory now that you need to advertise. And you know, it could be Facebook ads. They're still very powerful. Amazon is making a concerted push into the advertising space, and Amazon ads for books are really, really powerful right now. And there are other companies as well called BookBub that you might have heard of that's very powerful with the ads that it allows authors to place to find new readers. But it is getting to the point now that you do need, unless you've got a big audience, you do need to be prepared to advertise in order to find those readers.
And how much are we talking here? Like, do we need a bankroll of like $5,000 to be seen, or what are we talking about?
Again, it depends on, as I say, I did about 1.6 on the Kindle store last year. I was in Seattle to meet various Amazonians towards the back end last year. And one of the meetings I had was with my rep from a company called Amazon Media Group. So it's a kind of like an agency, an in-house agency that places ads on Amazon. And I'd been spending quite a lot of money with those guys, but we sat down for the kind of yearly review, and they said, well, first of all, the first slide, you've spent $500,000 with us this year. And I almost fell off my chair, because it was like, when it's kind of expressed that way, it was like, that's quite a lot of money. So that's fairly extreme. So not everyone will be able to spend that, nor should they. When I started out 5 years ago advertising, I started out with a $5 Facebook ad. I took that $5. Maybe for the first week or two, I lost money because I didn't really know what I was doing. But I invested that $5 and eventually figured it out. And then maybe I made $6. And then the next day I spent six, put it all back in again. Maybe the next day I made 10. And by within 2 or 3 months, I was spending between $100 and $200 a month. But that was all, I wasn't rich at that stage. I didn't have a big bankroll. That was just with building up slowly, scaling slowly and as carefully as I could, and then reinvesting the money that I'd made to buy more ads and then doing the same thing again.
Okay, well, that's great. Then you could start small and scale up. What were the ads pointing to? Because I know, for example, a lot of people who are in my podcasting course go, Pat, I want to use ads to promote people to my podcast, but that just doesn't work. And I'm curious, does that work with books? Like, here, go buy the book, or is there some special mechanism or campaign or way to go about getting people on Facebook who are there not to go buy books to go buy a book?
Yeah, that is the trick. So with the two main ad platforms are Amazon and Facebook. So for Facebook, people are not necessarily looking to buy something when they're on Facebook. They're probably scrolling idly through their newsfeed, looking for updates on what their friends are doing, you know, pictures of their, you know, what their friends were eating, all the kind of stuff that we love about Facebook. They're not really looking to buy a book. So your trick or the feat that you have to pull off is to get them out of that mindset and into the state of mind that they're thinking, actually, I'm not so interested in what I was doing. I'm going to go and click this link. I'm going to go to Amazon. And I'm going to buy this book. And it's tricky, but it's not impossible. And there are possibly beyond what we've got time for to talk about this evening, but you can do things like running engagement campaigns to build up an engagement audience on Facebook so that you know the people who have engaged with a certain type of ad at the top of the funnel. I hate to use marketing terms, but I'm sure your audience will know what I'm talking about there. You get them to, it's a cold audience, you get them to engage with the ad. Then Facebook allows you to serve them with a retargeting ad. So something slightly different in terms of the copy and the image. But at that point, you know that they have, at the very least, they're interested in the kind of books that you're writing and they have engaged with your ad before. Mm. If you build up that kind of audience, then it's a much warmer audience, much more conducive to clicking over to Amazon and then making that purchase. Now, on Amazon, of course, and this is why Amazon ads are so powerful, is people are looking for a book. That's why they're on Amazon in that part of the store. They're looking for a book. So if they want one of your books, Pat, then you want to make sure that if they've typed your name into the search bar, you want to be absolutely sure that the results reflect the books that you're offering them. And what you don't want to find is that Gary Vaynerchuk pops up.
Yeah, we don't want that guy else in there.
We don't want that guy.
I love you, Gary.
We don't want those guys popping up and sniping your readers before they get the chance to buy your book. So, but that's the thing with Amazon. It's a much different experience because people are actually looking for the books and they can buy them with a couple of clicks after seeing your ad. So different kinds of mindsets, different price considerations. Facebook's targeting is incredible. Amazon's not quite so much, but easier to get people to buy on Amazon than it is on Facebook. Swings and roundabouts, really.
That's super helpful. Thank you for that. I'm on your website, markjdawson.com right now. You have these just beautiful images. You were talking about the person who does your Photoshop and stuff, and it's really compelling. And it really highlights your books here. I see a John Milton series, Beatrix Rose series, Isabella Rose series, series, and then you have like one link for standalone books. Tell me the strategy behind series and what that's done for you as you've built your business.
Yeah, that's been a fundamental kind of a success point, I guess. And it's not one that I necessarily kind of engineered. I think I lucked into it a bit. But if you think about how you consume books as a reader. So who's your favorite fiction author, Pat?
Jeez. I want to say all of them. Orwell?
Orwell. Okay, good one. So let's say Orwell was writing today and you read, this is where I'm going to show my terrible ignorance here. Let's say you read 1984.
Okay.
And you really enjoyed it. You got to the end of 1984 and you're thinking, I'd really like to read another book in that series. So let's just say he wrote 1985 after 1984. What we've got there is we call that read through or sell through. So if someone gets to the end of one of my books, for example, they get to the end of The Cleaner, which is the first Milton book. I know at that point that they are interested in me as an author, or my character, or the way that I tell stories. So I can get them. I can do lots of things at that point. I can get them onto my mailing list, which is, you know, fairly standard internet marketing practice these days, is to build a list so that you can contact your customers directly. I can also persuade them to go over to Amazon and buy the second book in the series. And you can start to see that if you compare graphs over time, you can see it's like a wave. If you send lots of readers to the first book, after a couple of weeks, which is about the time on average it would take to read that first book, you'll start to see readers go to the second book. Not as many, probably about half. And then you'll start to see maybe 75% of those going to book three. Now, when you bear all that in mind, what it enables you to do is to make decisions on your advertising that will tell you how much you can afford to spend to get someone to buy book one.
Ah.
So it took me a long while to realize this, but if book one is selling for $2.99 at 70% on Amazon, I get, you know, $150, $160 in terms of a royalty. And for a long time, the longest time, I wouldn't spend more than that $160 profit that I was making because I thought I would immediately be making a loss. Now, by doing that and not taking into account the subsequent books that a lot of those readers would then go on to buy, I was switching off ads that were probably very profitable. So that's something that I'm very aware of now, and it is the reason why I write in series, because it's so much more it's so much easier to sell series and to make a decent return on series, because you will get readers just chewing through all of them. And that's still one of my favorite emails I get. Quite a few of them, which is lovely, but readers saying, I read The Cleaner 3 weeks ago, I've read all 16 books in the Milton series in the last 3 weeks, and I've never done that with another writer. That's incredibly flattering creatively.
That's cool.
It's also cool from the business side, because I know that instead of the $2.99 that they may have spent, they've probably spent $20 or $25 on those books, and I'm getting 70% of that, which when you kind of aggregate it with thousands of readers, before you know it, you can have a fairly successful business.
Yeah, that's incredible. I was also thinking about like Ernest Cline, author of Ready Player One.
Oh, good one.
And, and you had talked about like the other assets available, you know, that obviously turned into a movie and all this merchandise and all this other stuff, really cool things happened as a result. But then like his next book came out called Armada, and it was like in a different world, different setting, and it still did well because he did very popular, but it wasn't like... You don't go from Ready Player One to Armada as easily as if it was Ready Player One to Ready Player Two or Ready Player Three. And so I'm like, oh, there should be I'd be all over Ready Player Two if there existed something like that. But
me too. Also, there was quite a long gap between those books. He's not prolific. Not that there's anything wrong with taking your time, but the way Amazon works, it does reward authors who are able to write, who are able to provide their readers with a reasonably fast experience in terms of new content. And I think with Cline, I think it was maybe a few years, I think, between those books. Could be wrong, but I have a feeling it was.
So how long does it take you to write a new book?
Well, the fastest, my best year, so 2014, I was, I live in Salisbury in the UK, so not too far from Stonehenge. And I was working in the film industry, so I was commuting to and from London, which is about 90 minutes on the train each way. I had two small kids. I had one kid when my wife was pregnant on maternity leave. And also, adding into that, I was starting to get some success. So I started to, you know, get readers buying the books, emailing me, telling me how much they liked it. In that year, I wrote almost all on the train, maybe a little bit whilst I was at work. Don't tell my boss at the time. I would have got in trouble. I wrote about 1 million words in terms of published fiction. So around about, I don't know, I think I published 6 books that year, which was, I've never hit that again. Even though I'm full time now, I've never got near that because, I don't know, it's one of those things that the things you do kind of expand to fit the time you have to do them. But I think last year I wrote 3 or 4 books, and this year I'm aiming to do 4 or 5. So I can hit that reasonably comfortably. But, you know, kind of that's my thing. I would do it anyway if I wasn't being paid for it. I love writing.
That's amazing. I really want to write a fiction book one day, and it's just so inspiring. Do you, as a fiction author, like, dream about your characters? Do you, like, how do you,
yeah.
Do you think about them all the time?
Yeah, my wife has a thing. When we started seeing each other, I was just starting to get back to writing again. She used to say I had this kind of look in, I'd go into kind of a faraway space where I wasn't really in the room, and my eyes would glaze over, and she'd be like, "You're thinking about your books again, aren't you?" And I'm like, "Yep, yeah, sorry, I am." That happens. I get loads of great ideas when I'm walking. So I have a dog, so we walk in the countryside around here, and that's the best place I have for kind of riffing on ideas and solving plot problems. Also in the shower in the morning, which just goes to show that your mind's never really shut off. I'll often have good ideas when I'm in the shower, which must have been brewing whilst I was sleeping, I guess. You in that situation too?
Yeah, I mean, and for me, I even have not written a fiction book yet. Yet I still can imagine characters, and I'm thinking about storylines and plots and things like that. And so I'm just curious. I was just curious for a professional writer. It must be just exponentially much more. And for me, my best ideas come in the car or on the walks, on a run, during a row, or definitely also on a commute. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exercise is great because it's kind of bringing, it's a different part of your mind gets switched on, I think. It's kind of more meditative. So running, I feel the same way about running. You're just kind of doing something different. You're not really thinking in any kind of focused way, but you seem to be able to access parts of your brain where the good stuff brews. And that's something that I've definitely found.
How do you manage your fans? Obviously, many of my listeners here know I've written about super fans, and you've said yourself you've had people reach out to you and they're fans. And tell me about your fans. How are they great and how are they crazy?
They're almost all great, actually. The numbers game, I've bound to have had a few slightly unusual fan interactions, but generally speaking, it's all fantastic. And I'll give you a couple of examples of how things have changed over time. So when I was traditionally published, I'd never had an email from a reader or a letter, nothing, which was really disappointing because that was one of the things I thought would be fun, would be to have a conversation with someone who read my stuff. Mm-hmm. And I remember one time I went to a dinner party with a friend and she said, I've got something really cool for you, Mark. Just wait there. So she disappeared into another room, came back with one of my books. And she said, I was in a charity shop. So of course my ego is immediately crushed. She says, I found this. it was being sold for like £1 or something. So she bought it, and she opened it up, and inside was this letter. The second book was called, it was called Subpoena Collada. I was a lawyer, so it was kind of about, it was a satire about law. Lots of legal stuff in there. And this reader, who obviously knew more about law than I did, had gone through the book and had corrected all of the things I'd got wrong.
Wow.
These days, she would have emailed me with that, probably, and I would have been able to email back and say, thank you very much. You know, you are completely correct. I'm a very bad lawyer and I appreciate the time and effort that you've put into this. And I hope the things I got wrong didn't detract from your enjoyment. And maybe she would have become a big fan. But I couldn't do that because there was no way to get in touch with her. Now, scrolling forwards to how things are now, I've actually got on my desk right now a $20 note. And if I look over to my shelves on the other side of the room, I've got another three $20 notes that I've framed. And every Christmas for the last 4 years, there's a guy called Bob Walsh who lives in Washington in the States. And he sends me Christmas cards. And the first one, I was kind of knocked for six when he sent it to me. But he said he hadn't been into reading, or he'd kind of had a lapse from reading for 40 years. And he read one of my Milton books and that had revived his love of literature. And to thank me, he sent me a $20 bill and he asked me to go and buy a gin and tonic because he knows that's what I like to drink. And, you know, to as his way of thanking me, which was incredible. And then he's done it for the next 3 years. Now, I haven't spent any of those, as I say, I've framed them. And the reason I've done that is in the moments where I'm not confident that my stuff is as good as it needs to be. And like any other writer, I have moments of doubt and thinking that I'm a fraud and I can't write and all of that kind of stuff. I just need to look over at those framed 20s from Bob and think I've actually had an effect on someone. And he enjoys my stuff enough to have found my address out and to have sent four Christmas cards from the States to the UK with $20 in it. And maybe $20 is a lot of money to him. I don't know, but it's a really lovely experience to have that. And it's, you know, I'm thankful to say and very fortunate to be able to say that's not the only example of that kind of interaction that I've had with readers, which is all I ever really wanted. I mean, the money is nice, but to be able to provide someone with a bit of escapist fun, you know, people I've had readers in hospices who are, you know, at the last stages of their lives and they've found some peace and some enjoyment from my stuff or from readers like Bob who haven't read for ages. That's you can't really put a price on that. It's really nice.
That's really amazing, Mark. Thank you for sharing that. How do you communicate with your super fans now that we are in the sort of internet age? What do you choose to use, if anything, for just connecting in mass to your people?
So I'm kind of agnostic on the platform I use to do it. The philosophy is the same across all platforms. So it is, I respond to every single email and I respond as far as I can to every single Facebook message or comment. And that might just be liking a comment that someone may have left or a reply, but I try to at least let them know that I have noticed them and I appreciate the time they've spent in doing what they've done. Emails I will always reply to, because I think I remember when I was starting out, I used to love Bret Easton Ellis and Martin Amis over here in the UK. Mm. If I'd written a letter to them and they'd replied to me, that would have made my year, probably, to be able to have that kind of correspondence with a writer that I admired. And so, although I'm not comparing myself to either of those writers, it is possible that I can have that effect on readers too. And then kind of going beyond that, and it's a bit more commercial, but it's worth bearing in mind, if those readers then know that I am responsive and I listen and I appreciate the time that they spend in communicating with me, there's a very good chance that they will then go and tell their friends, and that cycle can begin again. So, you know, word of mouth, it's the most powerful form of advertising. We can't manufacture it, but what we can do is encourage it. And that is how you do it. At least that's how I do it. So I think just being there for readers and replying and being appreciative is really important.
In terms of fiction specifically, have you ever had any readers or fans sort of try to, you know, because I can imagine them getting really tied to the individual characters that you're writing about and access to the author to, you know, understand more about their favorite character or even help influence or determine, you know, what's going to happen next, perhaps before the next book comes out. Has that ever happened to you?
Yeah, I get people. I mean, I've generally speaking, you know, thinking of, you're kind of edging towards the Kathy Bates Misery territory there with super fans kind of kidnapping the writer and forcing them to write in a certain way, which is that kind of thing that it's never happened to me, thankfully.
Yeah, we
generally
don't want that.
Speaking, I'm quite fond of my ankles. I don't want them broken anytime soon. They're pretty good. It's not an issue as such, but something I've become aware of is I find it quite hard to end books sometimes. And I think it's because I used to work in the film and TV industry, and I've watched a lot of TV and a lot of film. And if you look at kind of binge TV these days, so Game of Thrones, things like that, all the episodes end on a cliffhanger, mm-hmm. because they want you to come back to the next show. And I think that has been something that's influenced me. And it is, cliffhangers are very tricky, because if you get someone who's invested, say, 10 hours of their reading time reading one of your books, and then you don't tie up all of the plot points at the end of the book, you're going to piss off some readers. It's just going to happen. And on the other hand, they will all buy the next book, even though they told you that they won't. They will go and buy it. So it's one of those things you kind of got to respect them. So in leaving really awful cliffhangers with, and I've done this before actually in one of my books, I left the heroine in a position of considerable danger. And I honestly, the response to that, the reviews were really aggressively negative. So I generally get good reviews, but this woman was getting 1 stars all the time. To the extent that I pulled the book down, re-edited it and uploaded it again with a slightly different ending. I still find myself kind of treading that quite carefully, the line between wanting to have something that's addictive and will lead people on to the next book, and also providing them with the closure that they need for the book that they've just read. So I'm still kind of working on getting better at that. That's not one of my strengths. And occasionally they will write in and tell me that.
For those of us listening who are in the middle of writing books or who are about to, and maybe we just keep putting it off and it's a scary thing to us, from a seasoned author like yourself, what are your best tips for us to just get writing and have that flow state that we need to crank these out?
So the first thing is, the best advice is arse in chair, right? So you have to sit down and you have to write. But then kind of going beyond that, it is, if you look at something, and I remember this from the first time I wrote, finished a novel, I tried to finish lots and never got there. Because it gets to a point where you can be a little bit daunted by the fact that, you know, it's 100,000 words, how am I ever going to get there? But if you break it down a bit, You know, I can probably, I think today I did about 4,000 words, which is a good day for me. Normally I hit about 2,000. But if you break it down, so maybe you've got a full-time job, right? So, or you've got two kids or you've got three kids and time is precious. If you maybe can carve out 10 or 15 minutes in your day, maybe half an hour, or you know, perhaps you commute on the train, maybe you get an hour. If you can spend that time writing, maybe you can do 500 words in the time that you have, which is, or even 100 words. If you aggregate that over time, over the course of a year, by the end of the year, you will have enough words to have at least a first draft of a novel that you can then go forwards with. So I think it's getting into that habit of actually getting your fingers on the keyboard and just telling a little bit more of the story, just working out where you want to go. There's nothing wrong with getting lost. So there's nothing wrong in writing yourself into a corner and then having to reverse back and go in a different direction, because every word that you write is making you better as a writer technically, and it's also teaching you to avoid those mistakes in the future. So it is, you know, and also you have to love it. If you don't love writing fiction, it's probably not the thing that you have been put here to do. But if you do enjoy it, you know, if you get a buzz, if you find yourself thinking about fiction ideas when you think you should be thinking about something else, then you know, maybe that's a itch that you need to scratch. And just sit down, you know, when you can, get some words down, and then do it again the next day, and then repeat.
And my final question for you, and thank you for this, Mark. This has been incredibly inspiring and very helpful for myself, and I know everybody else listening. When writing anything, really, nonfiction or fiction, but you know, for me, I'm thinking about myself selfishly here. When I had once tried to sit down and write a fiction thing, I would write something based on an idea I had, and then I would look at it again. And what I thought this was a great idea, I'd go, that's dumb. That's not going to work. And then I just kept going back to the drawing board and trying something again that I thought was a good idea. And then I'd see it. And then I'd be like, no, nobody's going to like that. And I kept fighting these demons in my head that what I was writing just wasn't good. And how do you commit to something when we're so, how do you commit to the words that you write when we're so easily dissuaded by those voices in our head that something's not good?
What you've just described there is every single writer in the world ever. So I get that. Imposter syndrome, you know, I might be reading something that I love, and I'll then come back to my stuff and I'm like, geez, I'm not as good as that guy. And it's insidious, and it can get in your head. And if you let it, you know, you will, you'll find an excuse to stop. And then maybe you won't write for 6 months, and then you try again and the same thing happens. Mm-hmm. The thing you have to do is you just got to block it out, right? You are the worst person to judge how good your writing is or how good your ideas are. You could not find a worse judge of the quality of a story than the writer. you need to push on. You got to, you know, maybe just finish a short story, you know, if maybe take something from the idea that you have, split it off, write a short story, which of course you could then use as, you know, again, to use another internet marketing term, you could use as a lead magnet, in ads to start to build your audience, a fiction audience. But once you've done that and you start to get, readers, and a key thing here is readers who are not related to you. So you could give your book to your wife and she might say, I love this, Pat. It's amazing.
She wouldn't say that. No, I'm just kidding. She would.
In the back of your head, if she did say that, you'll be thinking, yeah, you, of course you're saying that because you're my wife. I had that for a long time. I couldn't find any judge that I thought, you know, friends were the same. You know, they're saying that because they want to flatter my ego. Eventually, you have to put your big boy pants on and just put it in the world. And then Amazon's pretty good for that. It's very democratic. The book goes out there. You'll get reviews from people who've never heard of you before. And I remember very, very, very vividly the first 5-star review I had. I remember the first person joining my mailing list who was not related to me. And it is an amazing feeling because someone that you have no connection with, you don't know who they are, you don't know anything about their life, you have something in common that you've written something and they've read it and they enjoyed it. They got something out of that experience enough to have reviewed it or joined your list or whatever it was. And if you get enough of those kind of affirmations, before you know it, you feel a bit more confident about your writing. And, you know, I don't get that too much these days. Now and again, I do, but when I do, I can kind of, you know, look over that $60 in the frame on the wall over there and kind of think, yeah, I can, I've got this, I can do this. And that's just a lot of practice. But everyone gets that, but you can get over it.
Thank you for that, Mark. Where can people go to learn more about you? Where should they follow up?
Well, I'm selfishly going to give you two websites. So if people are interested in reading my fiction, if you like addictive, compulsive books, thrillers, you can go to markjdawson.com, and I have two free books that you can grab if you want to test me out by signing up to my mailing list. If you're a writer, and it's nonfiction or fiction, we kind of cater to both. I have some courses on how to self-publish, and then how to use ads to help you to self-publish, and some more stuff coming down the tube as well. And that is at selfpublishingformula.com. And we have a podcast on Friday as well, which is not anywhere near as good as yours, Pat, but you know, we have fun doing it, so it's a good laugh. So yes, those are the two places I'd recommend people check us out.
Awesome, Mark. You're amazing. Thank you so much for coming on and spending time with us today, and all the best on your next books.
It's a real pleasure to be here, Pat. Thanks very much.
Wow. Just wow. Mark, thank you so much for coming on. I know you listened to the show. I'm thankful to have featured you here on the show today, and I hope that this is inspiring to others, those of you listening, as it is inspiring to me. Two resources for you, markjdawson.com and selfpublishingformula.com. As you can tell, Mark's the real deal. He goes through the same sort of struggles, and I think his advice is just spot on, and I'm definitely going to take that with me moving forward, and I hope you do as well. If you'd like to get the links in a much easier fashion and also check out some of the other resources mentioned here in this episode, all you have to do is go to smartpassiveincome.com/session413. smartpassiveincome.com/session413, and you can check all those things out there. Thanks in advance for those of you who are going to leave a review after this. I just appreciate you so much. That helps energize me to keep going, and it helps other people who are not quite sure what to expect when they listen to the show that, yeah, this is legit, and I hope that you feel this is legit too. I appreciate you so much, and just want to say, make sure you hit subscribe, because we've got a lot of great stuff coming your way. I cannot wait to hear what you think about the upcoming episodes on the docket, and I'm not even going to spoil it for you because it's going to be a surprise. So make sure you hit subscribe, and I look forward to serving you next week. New episodes coming out every single Wednesday. That's how it's been, and I'm looking forward to serving you next week. And you can dive into the archives if you're hungry for more already. Cheers. Thanks so much. And as always, Team Flynn, you're amazing. Hashtag Team Flynn for the win. Peace.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Passive Income Podcast at www.smartpassiveincome.com.
Hey there, and thanks for sticking around to the end. If you're looking for more great shows like this one, definitely give How Success Happens a listen, another great show from the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. On How Success Happens, Robert Tuchman features some of today's brightest entrepreneurial minds talking about overcoming challenges and viewing them as learning experiences to create success. The challenges that entrepreneurs face are ultimately what make many of us successful, however we define success, and that's what the show is all about. There's lots of names you'll surely recognize on the show every single week. Just recently, Robert had Nasty Gal CEO Sophia Amoruso on the show, and the former CEO of Snapple the week before that, which is really awesome. So listen to How Success Happens right now on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or Stitcher.